This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we talk to Daniel Coyle. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Linda. How's it going?
Great, great. He is the author of The Culture Code, The Secrets of Highly Successful Groups. He spent 4 years researching military units, professional basketball teams, comedy troupes, and even a gang of jewel thieves to better understand how groups thrive or don't. The result is his book, The Culture Code. He'll explain what he's learned about how we can all better work together and how he's even applied what he's discovered to his own life. But first, a word from our sponsor. We'll start with a bit of trivia. In 1677, as I'm sure you all know, England passed something called the Statute of Frauds, which insisted that legal contracts must be in writing and signed. Well, that system then moved over to colonial America, and fast forward 3 centuries, we're all somehow doing the same thing on repeat. But at least there's now a better way to do it. Hallelujah. It's called Sign Easy. It's a simple, secure system for your business to digitally sign and distribute documents. You can scan and sign a document, have the system pass that document around to multiple people in whatever sequence you want, track the progress of that document, and even send reminders to the stragglers, the people who still need to put pen to paper, finger to screen. Can you imagine trying to explain this to the Parliament of 1677? Anyway, we today just call it the normal course of business. To get started for free, go to getsigneasy.com/podcast. How are you, Daniel?
I'm great. It's fun to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, thank you for making the time. I think people are really going to enjoy learning more about all of your research and all of your good work. Can you get us into sort of the process of researching the book and why you were so interested in cultures to begin with?
Yeah, I've studied performance, kind of the world's greatest performers. I have a very strange job. I basically travel the world looking at really people who are really, really, really good at what they do in all lines of work and in music and art and math and business and sport. And for the last 10 years or so, I've been studying performance, and I wrote a book which was called The Talent Code, which was about individual performers. And when I got when I did that research, I kept bumping into this mystery. And the mystery was, boy, some of these places I'm visiting feel different. You know, they feel really really magnetic, and the type of cohesion and cooperation you would feel was just extraordinary. It really came to a head. I remember I was visiting a tennis club, this amazing tennis club that has produced more top 20 women than the whole United States, this single club in Russia. And a little girl walked on the court, and the coach spotted her and came over and talked to the little girl and said, "Hey, can you do something for me?" And the little girl nodded, and she said, "Catch this ball." And she tossed the girl the ball. And it was just like this tiny interaction, but you could see the power it had in bringing that little girl who had never been there before into this tribe. And that tennis ball floating through the air kind of got me really interested in what's that made of? You know, these great cultures. When you walk into a great school, when you walk into a great restaurant, when you walk into a great family, when you walk into a great business, they feel different. And the word we use to describe that is culture. But that mystery, that deeper mystery is, what the heck is that made of? So I spent, as you mentioned, 4 years visiting some of the best cultures on the planet and seeing what they have in common.
I think that's really interesting. And I think the other thing that is sort of fascinating and sometimes a little frustrating is that we talk about culture all the time. Oh, they have a great culture. Businesses really tout their cultures. But no one seems to really know what an actual culture is, or even be able to sort of articulate that. Why is that? Why is there that gap?
It's because culture feels like magic. It's because culture feels, when you walk into a great place, it feels different. And that feeling is so intense, and we can feel it instantly. You know, you walk into a great place and you know it. You just feel it in the interactions. And so the word we use to describe that magical feeling is culture. But actually, and when we talk about culture, we sort of talk about these things like vision and leadership and values. But those words are all pretty vague. I mean, they're incredibly vague. I mean, going through life, thinking you can create a great culture by combining leadership and vision and values is kind of like going through life thinking you can create a Ferrari out of steel, red paint, and Italians. Like, they're nouns, they're things, but they're not actually a process, you know. And so what I saw in this place, in these visits that I made, in these places that I visited, in these extraordinary groups, was a shared process that was underneath the surface. That culture was really about a certain underlying grammar of interactions. There's a deep, deep pattern of interactions. That's what you're sensing when you walk into a culture. They have to do with creating safety. They have to do with sharing vulnerability. And they have to do with defining a purpose. And these are not magic. They look like magic. They feel like magic. They seem like magic. But when you really look closely, what it is a pattern, a grammar of interactions that is the same no matter what culture you're in. And that's because our brains are built the same way. You know, human brains are built to respond to certain types of signals when it comes to safety, vulnerability, and purpose. And these cultures succeed because they've aligned their interactions with the way our brains are built.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about how our brains are built and how that sort of translates into how we react in groups, right? There's a lot with sort of being in defense mode. Can you talk a little bit about this, like, sort of primal route that we have that we don't even realize we're reacting against every day?
Yeah. Right in the center of our brain are two little structures called the amygdala, which you probably heard of in biology class and probably heard of in popular press too lately. It's basically our danger sensor. It's our fight or flight responder, our scanner. It's constantly scanning the environment for threats, especially social threats, because growing, you know, as we evolved, being in a tribe was hugely important to survival. And knowing when you weren't in a tribe or knowing when you were in a bad tribe was also important because you needed to get out of there. So this sensor is the place where culture happens. And when this amygdala gets turned on, the fascinating thing about it is that it's either on or off. It's either get out of here or bond with these people. And so smart cultures realize that, and they flood the zone with signals of safety to sort of overemphasize how connected people are, to overemphasize how to share the space that people are in, to overemphasize the fact that they share a future. There's some amazing studies where a small signal at the beginning of a relationship that someone shares a future, that we are connected, that we belong, that I care about you as an individual, has huge downstream effects on connection later on how many people are still employed a year later, on how many people still feel connected to the organization or the group. So we're really built. This sensor in our brain, this amygdala, is exactly where culture happens. And one bit of science that we didn't know before, we always thought that this part of our brain just signaled danger. In fact, it also helps us bond. It pays keen attention to the faces of our group, to our shared connections. And so smart cultures are built around the amygdala. They absolutely flood the zone with these signals like we're safe, and they're small signals, but they repeat them over and over again because that's how groups get formed.
Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about how that sort of translates into sort of daily conversations, daily work, how things get done. You know, what is that grammar that you see? What are some examples that have played out from your research?
Well, there's sort of three big ones. In the book, I refer to them as skills because that's how they operate in groups. We think of them as being traits or something, but they're actually skills. And the first skill is build safety. You know, build this platform of caring to continually connect to individuals with these warm, unmistakable signals. The best example of this was this very simple experiment that was done with a company called Wipro. They had two groups of new employees. One group got the standard orientation, which was, we're going to tell you all about your new job and you're going to meet a star performer from the job. We're going to tell you how wonderful this place is to work. The second group got a different set of signals, which was, hey, what are you about? They asked the employees questions. What happens on your best day? What happens on your worst day? If we were on a desert island marooned, what skills would you bring to our survival? And 9 months later, the people in the second group stuck around 250% more often. stayed with the company with 250% more. And that difference is because they received the signal of safety. This is a safe place for you to be. We typically think of safety as being kind of an atmospheric, like it's kind of incidental. Oh, it doesn't really matter. It is by far the most important thing. If you send a signal of safety at the right time, you are you're aligning your signals with the way people's brains are built. You're having a huge impact on the downstream behavior. So that's the first skill. And the second skill, building on that, is shared vulnerability. Practicing the craft of group candor. Great cultures have these things called vulnerability loops. The loop is that it goes both directions. Leaders are vulnerable first, and then people are vulnerable back to them. I'm not talking only about vulnerability in kind of an emotional, touchy-feely way. I'm talking about vulnerability on like where you have weakness, where you have a bad job, where you need help. With groups, one of two things happen. We either manage our status and hide our vulnerability from others, or we stop managing our status and we open up our vulnerability. The most beautiful example of this is the first story I tell in the book, which is something called the Marshmallow Spaghetti Challenge. It's a very simple challenge, and it's to build the tallest tower you can out of 20 pieces of uncooked spaghetti, tape, and a single standard size marshmallow. And this challenge goes out to a bunch of different groups. Some are CEOs, some are MBAs, some are lawyers, and some are kindergartners. They all have 18 minutes to build the tallest tower they can out of those ingredients with a marshmallow on the top. And the end, it turns out the kindergartners win. And every time they beat the CEOs, they beat the MBAs, they beat the lawyers. And you know, if you had to bet your life savings on which one would win, you probably wouldn't bet on the kindergartners, because we sort of think that group intelligence is additive, that like smart people combine to form a smart group. But the reason the kindergartners win is not because they're smarter, it's because they're safer. The adult groups interact, but they all sort of talk and make plans and make suggestions behind in their brains. They're really thinking, do I fit in here? Is this safe? Is it okay? Who's in charge? They're managing their status. Kindergartners don't worry about status. Nobody's trying to be the CEO of Spaghetti Incorporated. The kindergartners all just start building and grabbing stuff and fixing it, and they build it and it falls down, they build it and it falls down and build it, and they learn something each time together. As a group, they're incredibly efficient. You know, it looks kind of chaotic, but they are much better at creating a group mind than the CEOs, who are much more careful, much more limited. So safety is not just a sort of incidental thing. It creates this kind of shared vulnerability. The kindergartens have more vulnerability loops. They look at each other, they fail, they fix it together. Without those vulnerability loops, you can't build anything. So that's the second skill, these vulnerability loops. And the third one is really road mapping purpose, to sort of flood the zone with the really vivid human stories that capture what your organization is about. Through metaphors, catchphrases, they sort of work like emotional GPS signals that guide us to where we want the group to go. So those are the three things. You build a platform of safety, you practice the craft of group candor with vulnerability, and then you roadmap your story in terms of purpose. You connect a group, you get the group to work together, and then you give it a target. It's sort of more of a functional model of culture.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. And I think one of the big surprises also is how fragile cultures are. And even if you've sort of built up safety and vulnerability, that it's very easy for that sort of to get destroyed. Can you explain to people a little bit about the bad apple study and sort of this fragility?
Yeah, it is remarkable. That was one of the things that really, you sort of think of culture as being, you know, absolutely, you know, strong and stable. In fact, it's not. You know, it's this flowing series of interactions that unfold over time, and they can be disrupted. I mean, there's some amazing experiments about how the bad apple, the effect of a bad apple on a group, they can diminish group performance by 30% to 40% just through like body language. You know, if you have somebody in a group who crosses their arms and frowns, group performance goes down, and not a little. It goes down a lot. So it is astonishing how important this kind of momentary unfolding feeling of being connected to others in this safe way where people are open, how powerful that is and how easily it is to disrupt it. And it goes back to the way our brains are built. You know, we're built to have this keen radar oh, this tribe isn't going well. Oh, the body language is bad. And it makes everybody else, it causes sort of a tidal wave of people checking out, all of which serves to point out the importance of leadership. The leader's role in this is massive, again, because of the way that we are sort of wired to behave. The shadow of leadership, the ripple effect of leadership. When a leader is vulnerable, it has a huge downstream effect. There was actually, I met a Navy SEAL commander. It was the guy who trained the soldiers for the Bin Laden raid, who told me the most important four words a leader can say are, "I screwed that up." Because it's kind of astonishing to hear that from a military person, no less, who's absolutely all about performance, absolutely all about delivering on a mission. But the reason that those words are so important is that it gives others permission to be vulnerable and to tell each other the truth of what happened, not to cover up and preserve their status and pretend like things are better than they are. The reason the SEALs are successful is the same reason that all the groups that I study in the book are successful. And that's because they're honest about weakness. They're honest about mistakes. They realize that "I screwed that up" is not an admission of weakness. It's actually an admission of strength. It says, "Hey, we can fix this together. I'm going to be open with you." That's kind of the weird sort of, I think, through the looking glass moment of a lot of this, where weakness, individual weakness shared equals group strength.
Yeah, yeah. Well, an instinct for a lot of people, especially when they're new to management, is that they need to fix everything. They need to be the one that has all the answers. They need to be sort of the wise sage that everyone comes to. And it's sort of been proven again and again that actually sort of is a faulty system, that it works for very simple things, but it doesn't sort of work in the long term, especially for very complicated projects. But still, why does this persist, right? Why is this the default for so many organizations that, you know, hey, we've got this sort of top-down, all-knowing leader when this doesn't really work?
That's a great question. I think part of it is just sort of the way these sort of social structures and businesses have evolved. You know, the structure of modern business evolved during an era where, as you say, a lot of the problems were a little bit simpler. You know, if your problem was to build a Ford car on an assembly line, having a leader who told everybody exactly what to do was a really good idea, and it was really efficient. But today's businesses are not just assembling things mindlessly. You know, creativity is a requirement. Collaboration is essential. And you need to have businesses and organizations that are intelligent together, that are add up to more than the sum of their parts. And so this instinct that we should look up to the leader and he should or she should give us the answer is sort of understandable, both with our own biology to sort of look for a hierarchy, and also historically it's understandable, but it's exactly the wrong thing to do. And the leaders that I met in the book always had the same response in those situations. Ed Catmull, who's the co-founder and president of Pixar, the words he said the most were, "Now it's up to you." That's what he would say to his people when there was a big problem. And they were looking to him for a solution. They would look to him, "What should we do with this movie? What should we do with this team?" And he would always say the same thing, "Now it is up to you," which is a hell of a powerful thing to say, because it says, look, you guys, we're stronger together than I am. And they're able to overcome that kind of instinct through a message of essentially vulnerability to say, "Hey, I don't have the answers, but we can come up with them together. Let's start that."
Yeah, yeah. And Ed Catmull's story was so interesting, because whether you are on sort of the creative end or you know you're sweeping the floors, he brings you in to look at, you know, the projects while they're sort of in development, to say, "Hey, you know, everyone here is involved in making our next project better, making it better." And I think one of the things that was really interesting through a few of the cultures that you had was the role of food, right? It's very, very simple, right? But whether it was the Spurs or whether it was Pixar, the idea that bringing people together around a table is really a powerful way to cue that people belong. Why does this work? Why is this so simple, and why does it work?
Well, you know, when you think about, you know, what do human beings do in a tight circle? You know, and eating is probably at the top of the list. It happens all the time. It is a lovely, shared, egalitarian experience where people can have these kind of experiences that don't have to do and conversations that don't have to do with work. But each of the places I visited, it's fascinating. I haven't really thought about it deeply until you mentioned that, but you're right. That was the vehicle for togetherness. That was the vehicle for safety, really. One thing that happened a lot was I think they went out of their way to make it really special. You know, I tell the story in the book, the San Antonio Spurs coaching staff, they all go to dinner the night before a game. And at the end of the season, they get a keepsake book that has got the menus of all the places they visited and the labels of the wines that they drank together. And, you know, it's kind of corny, like a lot of this culture stuff can be. It's hugely meaningful. And it's really pretty cool because it says, hey, that was a really special time and we appreciate it. We enjoyed spending time together. So it is this wonderful opportunity to connect. And at each of the places, whether it's, okay, we're going to have slightly bigger lunch tables at work so that people can gather and exchange ideas, or we're going to have these special times together, it is a huge opportunity. There was somebody else this guy who studied sociometrics, who what I think was, if you're eating lunch at your desk, you're making a huge mistake. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think it's also where a lot of businesses go wrong, and frankly, where a lot of leaders and just regular people go wrong, right? Where if you think, oh, if I just have a cool coffee machine, if I have a snack program, if I have this, I'm giving a great perk to my employees and I'm kind of done, right? But it's not that easy, right? And so you still need to have a situation where if there is a group meal that the boss is taking time out to have the group meal, or if you have a perk or we're all going out to drinks, that you have it at a time when everyone can participate and you plan it in such a way that people can go. Because each one of these courtesies, you become a host, right? Like when you talked about the San Antonio Spurs, there was a dinner where the team had a terrible defeat, and they had planned sort of a victory dinner, but the dinner, and they lost, and they kept the dinner, and the coach went around sort of like, I think the description you had in your book was that he was sort of like the father of the bride, right? That you become a host. And why are those cues so important? I think that that's kind of where things can fall apart, right? You make sure, just like if you were having someone at your home, you make sure that people know that they matter and that they're wanted. I mean, why is that host element so critical?
Well, it shows care. It sends this amazing signal of safety that says, look, I see you. And it's interesting. You can actually look at this from a very scientific perspective. There's people who study sort of how safety is created, and it comes down into sending like three basic cues: energy. I'm putting energy toward you. Individualization. I see you as a unique human being that no one else is like, and I see that. And shared future. I realize that we're going to be doing things together, and I look forward to that. Like, that is incredibly caveman simple and incredibly caveman powerful. Like, the idea, especially when we've got these little radar detectors and these early warning systems in our brain wondering, we just lost this game. What's my future like? So especially at these moments of crisis, it is a huge leverage point to reach out and you see it in every good culture, when someone is sick, when someone is hurting, when someone loses someone in their life. Those are the moments where it is by far most important to reach out and see that person as an individual and express care. It sounds very sort of touchy-feely and soft. It's hard. It's actually there's a physics here that is incredibly rigorous and true and disciplined no matter who you are. When you reach out at those moments, you're building this bond that is real and does not go away. So it ain't soft skills. They are the hardest of the hard skills.
Yeah, yeah. And I think when you sort of talk about all of us as sort of like a little kind of apes, right, walking around our workplaces, right? And then you start to see behaviors for what they are, people maybe pulling away from the group, some people maybe acting more aggressively than others. When you just look at it just as sheer behaviors and nothing else sort of laid on it, right? Then you realize that something needs to be done, right? Someone doesn't feel like they're part of this. Someone else maybe isn't acting in a productive way, right? What are the things that anybody can do, the little alignments that they can do, whether it's throughout the day or in those moments when someone's got their head down or they're scanning through their phone on a meeting, right? What are those little moments that they can do to sort of pull someone in or, you know, just fix things, to check in with the group and try to do their part to create something positive?
Yeah, I think there's some several. One thing is to kind of work on your 20 square feet of culture. You know, everybody's got this area around them that they are. Proximity is huge in this. So working on that by sending a very powerful way to crack through is to send a signal of vulnerability, to ask for feedback. If there's somebody who's sort of drifting from the group or being a bad apple, reaching out to them and asking them a question about yourself and say, hey, I need your help. How am I doing on this? What can you tell me about some recent project that I worked on that can make me better? And making it kind of about creating that vulnerability loop. You can't sort of force someone to be vulnerable, to sort of, okay, tell me about your weaknesses. We tend to take a straight ahead path in that interaction. But what you can do is be vulnerable with them and then give them the opportunity to respond. You can't say for sure that they will, that they'll say, hey, I need some feedback too, or hey, I've had some struggles too. But that's one way. That's one way to do it. Another way is to kind of, if you're to sort of maximize collisions, to find ways. That's one another common thing that happens in these cultures is there's just more interaction. There's just more hanging around the coffee maker. There's just more more collisions everywhere. And a lot of these places go so far as to have a huge amount of intent in the way they design space. The hallways are a little extra wide. The gathering places are a little bigger and have a lot of comfortable places to be, to sort of create these collisions that allow people to hang out and connect in a very safe environment. You know, the coffee makers are very high quality. Sort of making little things to tilt people toward those casual whole person interactions that help a group bond. Finding ways to do that.
Yeah. No, I think that's really, really interesting. And I think that there's still this element, right? So people are used to what they're used to, right? And so if they don't maybe have the skill sets, or they haven't worked in a functioning culture, they don't know how it could be, right? And so if they feel like there's too much broken, they feel overwhelmed, they don't know what to do, whether they're a leader or even if they're just sort of like a team leader. They've got maybe a small group, you know, they're sort of that they help sort of push projects forward, you know? How can one person make a difference, right? When there's still only so much impact any one person can have on, you know, where they work, maybe even the layout of the desks, you know, and things like that. How should they be thinking about this, right? Because it does come down to mindset at the end of the day. How can they, one person, make a difference and make a positive contribution to their culture and also, frankly, to their own work day?
Right. Yeah, I think it comes down. There's a few things you can do. I mean, you know, to actually focusing on that immediate environment around you. As I said, that 20 square feet has a big impact, because there's a lot of things about culture you can't control. There's a lot of things about the big picture that maybe you can't control, but maybe you can control the environment and the interactions that happen right around you. You know, seeking. Another thing you do is kind of overthink people. That's something that I see in every great culture. They don't just kind of – it's easy when you're around people a lot and you have got a normalized set of interactions that you have where it just becomes expected that certain things are going to happen. There is an acute awareness in good cultures of overthinking, to really make that contribution, that whatever those people made, to make it really clear that impact that it had in very specific ways, and whether that thanking, that thanking is of course best done in person. Another thing that people can do in a very very similar way is, if you ever have to tell somebody no about anything, don't do it digitally. Don't or email. If you have any no environment, do that in person. Again, that connects to shared vulnerability. That's an opportunity for you to sort of endure this kind of slightly difficult thing, and for them to kind of endure this, and it can bring you closer rather than to do it defensively and behind the sort of veil of a computer screen. In all these things, the larger picture is to kind of embrace things that are slightly uncomfortable, to be slightly more open about your weaknesses and about what you want to accomplish. And that's at the core of this. That's what this is about. Groups that tell each other the truth, groups that build closeness. We've got a fundamental misunderstanding of what builds trust. We tend to think that we'll build trust together and then we'll take a risk together. In fact, the way our brains work and the way the world works is when you take risks together, that builds trust. When you jump off a high ledge together with someone, you get connected with them in a deeper way. And so finding ways and seeking ways in your environment to take little risks with people will build trust. You can't wait for that trust to build before you take a risk. Those little risks you take over and over again build this connective tissue of trust. And so that's what I would advise people, to seek ways to take small risks.
Yeah, yeah. I think also there's this element you were talking earlier about sort of a rewarding and thanking people. And it gets me thinking about the recent story with Susan Fowler, right, who worked at Uber. She was an engineer at Uber. And there was leather jackets that were given as sort of a reward to her team. But there was more men on the team than women, and they could get a discount for the men's jackets because there were so many of them, but they'd have to pay retail for the women's jackets. And so in the end, they opted not to buy jackets for the women. And it's a small thing. And probably that boss probably felt like, oh, well, we're still helping most of the team, right? So statistically, we're still helping most of the people, and it's just a jacket and everyone's a grown-up. But at the end of the day, there's still people. There's still six women in this case that got left out, who are like, hey, how come everybody has a jacket but me, right? And so it's these little elements where it's not a reward if people feel bad about it, you know?
I haven't heard that story. That is amazing. Right. Right. If you really understand, you know, how cultures work, that jacket is a huge deal. And to do it in a not just kind of an equitable way, but of this sort of, you know, what a great opportunity that gets missed when something gets mishandled like that. They had, and it really goes to underline the fact that this is the clock never stops on culture. You know, it never stops. They did a good project. They had a good idea to reward people. They did everything right, except they screwed it up in the end, and that screwed up everything. So it is an incredibly, never ending, which is why learning how to play this sport and learning how, oh, wait a minute, that's actually this incredible signal of safety that we're blowing, that we're screwing up because we screwed up this jacket thing. And now everybody's ticked. So the clock never stops, and a basic understanding of, okay, what do each of these signals mean, and how can we kind of knit them together? The sort of flip side of that is that when you understand how culture actually works, it in some ways lessens the demands on leaders. When leaders have to be all-knowing and all-powerful, it's really hard. But if you just understand, look, all I need to do is make sure that the team knows it's up to them, overthink them, set out the purpose really clearly, share some vulnerability. There's like an elegant simplicity to that model of leadership that actually makes for easier, happier lives.
Yeah. You had an interesting example in your own life that since you'd been researching this book, you had a chance to sort of apply some of these ideas with a group of school kids who were in a writing team. Can you talk a little bit about prepping for The Power of the Pen?
Yeah, it was really fun. I've coached, you know, baseball a lot of years, and I've coached writing. Actually, they have this cool writing competition where I live, middle schoolers, and they all the schools compete, and they try to write great short stories and with prompts. And I'd coached the team for a few years, but I was researching these cultures, and I decided to steal some of the ideas and start applying to the team. What I had done in the past as a coach was kind of the typical coach model. Like, I would come in, I'd give them a little talk, I'd give them some wisdom. They would write their stories. I would give them feedback on it. I was the sage on the stage, as the thing goes. I was the person who had the answers. For this particular year, I sort of flipped it. I started being really vulnerable with them. I'd bring in examples of my own writing and show them these mistakes that I made, show them how bad these rough drafts were. I would really make it clear why we were there. I would over-communicate our purpose, which was to make a lot of good mistakes and get smarter about it. I would put the burden not on me to give the answers, but on the group to give the answers, on the group to evaluate each piece of writing and to suggest ways to make it better. And we came up with a nice sort of model that we borrowed from somebody, which was each work we evaluated on a WWWEBI basis, which is what worked well and even better if. We started with kind of this safe space, the positive. This is what we really liked in this story. And then EBI, what was missing? What do you need to add? And as a result, we had a completely different feel of interaction, completely different vibe, all that kind of magical feeling of this, oh, this is a fun team and this is a cohesive team. And we ended up, you know, performing really, really well throughout the year. As a leader, it put different demands on me a little bit. I had to sort of pay deeper attention to each individual. I couldn't just sort of trust if I knew the answer, that was the goal. I really had to focus on the interaction. I really had to focus on supporting the writers as they went through, as they learned, and getting to know them as people, as individual writers, their own strengths and weaknesses. So in some ways it was harder, in some ways it was easier, but it was definitely more successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what surprised you about that experience and sort of how the kids reacted?
You know, how much they kind of embraced it. Like they were so, you know, you get sort of used to in school of just sort of being passive, just like you do in work, right? You know, just being, oh, tell me what to do. I'll do it. And I'll hit the mark. But when you sort of flip it and say, hey, now it's up to you, you know, you guys are the way that they were able to embrace it, and through embracing it, deeply improve their writing in ways that I don't think any of us could have anticipated. They got so much better. And, you know, if you were to, it's sort of an oddly scientific way to think about it, but I think if you were to do brain scans of our team, they would have been lit up in a completely different way. You know, they would have been feeling really bonded, feeling like they owned the work in a way that they weren't just trying to please me. They were deeply engaged. You know, we use that word a lot, engaged, but it's not magic. It was set up by this environment, by the signals that I sent in that environment. And the early signals I sent and the signals I continued to send had a continuing impact on that team. And it was fun to see.
Sure. And how else has this sort of research sort of changed how you look at people? You're just even just sort of walking around and living your life. I mean, how has this research changed how you sort of see people in groups in your world?
It's kind of like having a pair of goggles on, you know, where you're sort of able to see really quickly good cultures and bad cultures. You know, you watch the interaction and I was taught this by Danny Meyer, actually. How he looks at the world. Danny Meyer's head of Union Square Hospitality Group. He's a restaurateur who's opened about 20 of the most successful restaurants on the planet, including Shake Shack. He says, in every interaction, energy either goes up or goes down. It's not neutral. It's not flat. It either goes up, it goes down. And especially when there's a crisis or a problem. If there's a problem and people are interacting, either there is going to be this addition of energy and people are going to be better afterwards because they helped each other and they had genuine generosity toward each other, or there's going to be some bit of anger and resentment that this problem happened. That is the litmus test. That is the litmus test. If you're in a coffee shop and something spills, watch the interaction. Does the energy go up or down? If it goes up, then that's a good culture. If it goes down, then that's a bad culture. Watch a pro sports team. Watch what happens when they make a mistake, when somebody strikes out or drops a pass or misses an easy basket. What happens to the energy of the team? Does it go up or does it go down? That will tell you all you need to know. So that's been the powerful thing for me, because it makes you not only move through the world with a lot more knowledge and efficiency and less mystery. Culture isn't some magical thing that certain groups have and certain groups don't. It's this language that people are speaking. And when you tune into that language and say, okay, are they speaking it there or not? It makes your life a lot more simple. And then you can get better at speaking that language. It's saying, look, if there's a problem, I'm going to show up. I'm going to really try to help and make a difference. And that's going to have a huge impact on everybody around me.
Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have. But thank you so much, Daniel, for all of this.
Hey, it was really fun. I think you have a great culture, Linda, and it's been fun to be a part of it.
That's wonderful. Well, I know that your insights are going to have some real resonance with people. And unfortunately, that is our show. And for our listeners, a little reminder that how success happens comes out weekly. To make sure you don't miss a single episode, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't be afraid to leave us a review. It helps us improve and reach more listeners just like you. For more stories like this one on the mindsets that you need to have to start and grow a business, go to entrepreneur.com. And to let me know what you think about this show, find me at Twitter at Linda Lacina. That's LINDA LACINA. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.